I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
I'm going to give the audience what I think they want.
They want chase scenes and car crashes.
They want the cops to bend the rules to get the job done. They want the boy to get the girl. They want the good guy to win. They want the bad guy to die, hopefully in the biggest explosion the budget will allow. But most importantly, Senator, they want to walk into a theater and for 90 minutes forget the fucking mess that you have left of this nation.
Go get your bubblegum.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Hello and welcome back to All Out of Bubblegum, the podcast. Today we are going to be talking about some oldies but goodies, The Most Dangerous Game, and The Island of Lost Souls, both from 1932. Today we have Marty and Brandon, and I assume, Brandon, that you're like just big fans of these old films.
Yeah, I love these movies. In fact, they're my two favorite pre-code films of all time. Well, of the pre-code era, I guess. That's 4 years. But anyway, and these right here, this is the real cinematic Pulp Fiction, not that neo-noir stuff that Quentin Tarantino dished out to us. I mean, when it comes to Pulp Fiction on the silver screen, this is the real deal right here.
No love for Babyface?
Oh, Babyface is good too, but I'm all about
Scarface.
Scarface is probably like that's in the top five for sure of my favorite pre-code films. But
any other face movies?
Face, not that I can think of. Face Off, that's not pre-code.
I find a certain charm to the older films of this era. I something about them that I always appreciate is the general lack of score.
Yeah.
I think that it kind of instead the film itself creates the atmosphere rather than you be kind of hit over the head with a musical number.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I have sort of the opposite. Like, I like how bombastic and hard and loud the score is when it does come in.
I think Most Dangerous Game has like, has a bit of it, but yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess that's probably the best place to start here. Are you guys aware of the story beforehand of either of these, I guess?
I read the Richard Connell story, The Most Dangerous Game, in high school, but I don't remember much about it because that's been a while. But it's fairly similar to the 1932 film, other than like they added a love interest, obviously, to the movie to make it more commercial. But, I mean, it's pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I am aware only insofar that I am aware that they exist. Okay. I have not read either.
I didn't realize until I started up The Island of Lost Souls how close these films were in like kind of style and mm-hmm. plot, which is basically, you know, there's a shipwreck or something and then they end up on an island and they end up leaving on a little boat.
Yeah. Like, yeah, they're on a madman's island. Yeah.
It's like, I'm like, that's funny. But, yeah, I don't know. This is not super action-heavy, but it is very, like, tense.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of Naked Prey, which I also highly recommend anybody watch.
Okay. I haven't seen that one yet.
The Naked Prey, an epic tale of pursuit and survival, as one courageous man is singled out to be hunted like a lion.
I think it's probably my favorite film of that year. It's like 1964, I think. 64, 65, somewhere in there. But very similar, where it's just some, you know, they're running around through the jungle trying not to get killed. Although in this, it's straight up a hunter. Although he himself is a hunter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like this.
Yeah, they make a point of that. In fact, it kind of hits you over the head in the beginning. They're like, oh, I hope I never got
Yeah. Joel McRae, who plays the lead character here, is hilariously daft. I mean, like, Count Zaroff, who's the bad guy, says, hunting was starting to bore me, so now I hunt the most dangerous game. I hunt humans. Then McRae says, you mean tigers? Then, like, later on, Zaroff has, like, Joel McRae strapped into some bondage equipment, and they're, like, in his trophy room. And the count says, to get contestants for my hunting, I move the channel lights next to my island. And then, like, Joel says, how do you get your victims, you madman? Oh, wait, you must have moved the channel lights. Yeah. So, Joel McRae, not the brightest bulb here, but that's part of the appeal, I guess.
Come, my dear Rainsford.
I don't want to treat you like my other guests. You and I, we are hunters.
So that's your most dangerous game.
I liked him a lot more as a protagonist than the lead in Island of Lost.
Richard Arlen, yeah.
Fair.
Because I actually think he has some agency, he does some stuff, he's proactive. And he doesn't cheat on his wife the first chance he gets.
There is that, yes.
That's because the love interest is Faye Ray, so...
Yeah, and she was the original Scream Queen, but she's the smart one here. She's the one who's, like, mm-hmm. onto Count Zaroff's plot to, like, hunt people for sport, and Joel McRae is just like, I like tigers.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Robert Armstrong, mm-hmm. her brother. It's just like the drunken brother that's just like, oh, he's just having a good time. He doesn't care. He's just completely oblivious to what's going on.
Yeah, he's comic relief and all. And he was kind of deliberately annoying because the filmmakers wanted to show the evils of alcohol. And this was still during Prohibition, like the last 2 years of Prohibition. And I like having the comic relief character get killed halfway through the runtime. That's pretty amusing.
Yeah.
There's no way that hunt was... that's no. why it's off screen. That guy passed out on the steps outside.
But he gave him 2 hours to sober up. That's more than enough.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
I was like, this guy is sloshy drunk. He doesn't need 2 hours. He needs 2 days.
He was just walking through the jungle looking for something to eat, like a kebab shop or something, yeah. shawarma, whatever.
He probably turned around and was like, are you shooting at me? Yeah. You know.
But I think that's the good part because Zaroff presents himself as a very honorable hunter. And that's like the first clue we get that he isn't honorable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think they show but, quite effectively at the end again as well. I really like it. Yeah.
Well, he's straight up going to shoot him in the back mm-hmm. at the end.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the action scenes. I mean, when they're doing the chase scenes... the movie's great. I love, like, the camera work, and there's even kind of, like, a POV shot of them, like, going through the jungle with, like, the leaves and the branches and stuff. That stuff is fine. Now, the hand-to-hand combat, that kind of feels kind of clunky by today's standards. People are just, like, flailing their limbs around, but it has a certain appeal. You can tell there's some choreography behind it. Like, there was something that was planned as they're, like, flailing their arms around and stuff and knocking over tables. And, it's pretty fun, I would say, overall, in the action department. The last half of the movie is pretty much straight action adventure, but there's some stuff in, like, there's a lot of dialogue and build-up in the first half, but it moves very fast because it's only an hour long. This movie is, like, 63 minutes long.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's a lot of good still in the film. Short as it is, they pack quite a bit in there. My favorite part is when... they go down into the cave and he's out there just like taunting them.
Is that?
Or he's like, you think you can ambush me in a cave? He's like, oh, okay. You want to act like a leopard? I'll hunt you like a leopard. You know, this whole thing.
Oh, very well. If you choose to play the leopard, I shall hunt you like a leopard.
And I like that stuff.
Yeah, that's great.
But most of the movie I spent going, oh, Hard Target took a ton from this movie and is really playing around with the concept, like down to what Van Damme is dressed like and the villains, the way he's dressed is sort of like how Arnold Vosloo was dressed, and then the piano playing as well. Mm-hmm. There's these little notes that I'm like, oh, they're just replicating these things in Hard Target. And that's what I kept thinking about when I was watching the movie.
Yeah. Personally, I prefer The Most Dangerous Game to its imitators because of its pulp aesthetics and its one-hour-long runtime. But I still love Hard Target. That's still one of Van Damme's best.
I think it's one of John Woo's best. So it's like, wow, that movie, I mean, you get the master of action. If this movie lacks in action, that movie brings it all the way. Oh, yeah, he also calls his men his dogs in one scene. In Hard Target, and I'm like, oh, that's a callback because this guy uses dogs.
Yeah.
He's more of a, what you would call like a gentleman hunter. So in terms of like like you get the impression that our main character, Joel McRae's character, is a real hunter. Like he gets down into the muck himself, and he's hunting. Whereas Zaroff is kind of a, you know, he brings the foxhounds out and probably rides with a full crew, mm-hmm. and they wound the animal or whatever, and then he takes a shot. That's the impression I get. Whereas Joel McRae is more like the real deal, where he's like, you know, even though the other guy's like, oh, I can hunt with a bow, this guy's like, no, I'll get down to the muck and spend 3 days in the cold mud or something, hunting something.
Yeah, Kyle Zaroff is a cheater.
He's like the predator. Where you're like, yeah, he's just such an overwhelming advantage that, come on.
Yeah, there's a bit of an implied maybe class difference between the two.
Yeah.
Zaroff is definitely represented as more of a just a rich elite guy. So yeah, he would be more used to hunting with a group for sport, for, as you say, with the foxes and wounding the animals just so that they can go to the club and say, oh, we got him.
Yeah.
And I think they show that really well in the showdown, that, like you said, Joel McRae gets more down and dirty because he's used to the real stuff.
In fact, when it comes down to it, he takes out Zaroff first before going and defeating all his little underlings.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Which is kind of a nice turn on things, that, because you don't expect that. You expect him to be the big bad, but instead he takes him out pretty much and then fights off the guys. And then a wounded Zaroff is like, oh, we'll shoot you in the back then, and then just dies, falls down and gets torn apart by his dogs, presumably.
Yeah, there's a great scene during that final action sequence where, like, Joel McRae pulls a move that's, like, positively Seagalian. He, like, takes, like, one of the henchmen over his back and snaps the guy's spine. And I did not expect that the first time I watched this movie. I mean, they even have a sound effect for, like, the snapping. The audio commentary for the Criterion Collection Edition says that they did that sound effect by, like, snapping a piece of wood. And, yeah, you can tell. I mean, it's a great piece of action choreography for the time right there.
Yeah, it's surprising. It was like we're doing like a judo move. The first one, he held the guy down. You know, he had him in a pretty significant kind of like wrestling pin. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting move to do. And then I was like, oh, he's like full on doing something here. And then he grabs the guy wrapped around his back and breaks his back. I was like, oh, cool.
And I actually like all the fight scenes. You said they were a bit old fashioned, you said they were a bit old fashioned, but that's what I like about them.
Yeah.
It just seems like two guys fighting for real, just punching each other in the face.
Yeah, it looks a little more realistic. It's not really choreographed, or it doesn't feel it at least.
Yeah, that's fair to say.
Yeah, and that quality I like about it. Some of the punches seem like they really, really hit and really hurt.
And circling back to the musical score aspect, the musical score for The Most Dangerous Game was done by the pioneering Max Steiner. And it's exceptional, I think, that dun, 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 dun. That theme is great. In fact, The Most Dangerous Game was one of the very first talkies to have an original musical score that played frequently throughout the runtime. At the time, music for movies would sometimes just kind of play over the beginning and the end title for these talkies, or the score would consist of pre-existing tunes. But for The Most Dangerous Game, Max Steiner brought out the big guns, and he did something fantastic. It's really catchy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think having it only at the start and at the ending is something that the other movie we're going to talk
about. Yes, that is correct.
Yeah.
I'm not quite aware of when talkie started.
I believe the first like movie that's considered a talkie was The Jazz Singer from 1927, but I watched that and there's actually a lot of silent scenes in that movie, so it took a while for like the fully talking music motion picture to catch on for like a little while. But by 1930, I think like pretty much all films were talkies at this point. So this is like 2 years into that.
Well, it makes sense that they didn't want to immediately stuff them with music and dialogue.
Yeah. They were kind of I mean, this was the Great Depression, too, so they probably didn't have, like, a lot of money to pay composers. I mean, this was kind of, like, a fairly prestigious film, I think, for the time. I mean, not prestigious. I mean, it's a horror movie, action horror movie, but it was, you know, a big budget, relatively modestly budgeted film, I guess.
Yeah.
But it doesn't look cheap. It looks gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it was filmed on some of the same sets as the 1933 version of King Kong.
Oh.
Yeah, well, the team, pretty much the whole team came back. You know, you brought up Max Steiner. You know, he comes back for Hong Kong, and obviously Fay Wray and Robert Armstrong. Who King gets Kong. The big famous, you know, the line at the end of King Kong, you know, it was beauty that killed the beast.
Yeah, and you can kind of say the big log set at one point, which is like the scene where King Kong, like, shakes the sailors off the log and they fall into the pit. Yeah, they run across that log at one point, the heroes of the Most Dangerous Game.
It's funny because that's like, I didn't notice it was the exact same one, but my brain was like, oh, that reminds me of King Kong when they ran.
Yeah. I think it's the same set.
Yeah. The dogs are running.
And speaking of the dogs, I think like the audio commentary for this on the Criterion Collection DVD says that they were borrowed from Harold Lloyd and they did not look threatening, so they painted them black. And then, like, so Harold Lloyd was not exactly happy when they returned the dogs, but that's what you get for loaning your dogs to, like, a project from the 1930s.
Yeah.
And I kind
of... Pulled it to lead paint.
Dude, you had a lot of... Why did he have so many dogs?
And, I actually thought they were kind of, like, hurting the dogs for real, like, before I heard the story, but, like, I guess they probably wouldn't hurt Harold Lloyd's dogs for real, I mean, if they returned them. Because there's, like, some nasty-looking stunts that the dogs get involved in where they, like, drop them into some water, or Joel McRae is like pretending to stab them at one point.
That dog is just playing with him.
Yeah.
I was like, anybody who's been around big dogs knows they'll just jump up on you. And yeah, it's fine.
Okay. Joel McRae had to act scared. I guess he's a good actor then.
I liked that whole scene when they're stuck at the waterfall. It was great.
Very intense.
I was like, oh, shit. How are they going to get out of this? And then you're like, oh, he doesn't.
Yeah. Well, he sort of does.
Yeah. There's a little, like, yeah, I survived. Just walks in the door later. You're like, okay.
And I did it all on purpose.
Yeah. Threw that before I even came in the room.
But I do like the way that that waterfall sequence is handled with, like, pretty much no dialogue other than, like, Fay Wray screaming. And, like, at the end of, after he, Count Zaroff thinks that he killed Joel McRae, he kind of, like, walks back to Fay Wray with his, like, rapey face on his, rapey expression on his face, and there's no dialogue, but you know that something bad is going to happen. And it doesn't quite happen, I don't think, because I think Joel McRae comes to the rescue at the end and prevents Count Zaroff from having
his way. Set it up because... Earlier, he talks about basically you kill your what you're pursuing, your blood is up, and then you get the woman.
He talks of wine and women as a prelude to the hunt. We barbarians know that it is after the chase and then only that man revels.
It does seem a bit like cocktails before breakfast.
Of course, yes. You know the saying of the Ogandi chieftains: hunt first the enemy, then the woman.
So that is set up.
But I do think Joel McRae probably rescued Fay Wray before she was violated. At least that's the impression I got.
No, I think he deliberately waited until after. No.
He was just waiting outside the doors listening.
Like, when are they finished so I can go in?
He's a voyeur like Dr. Moreau.
Yeah. Well, it is a bit surprising because both bad guys, but also Leslie Banks in this one, they are what you would now call queer-coded.
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I do like the way Count Zaroff kind of imitates Joel McRae on a couple occasions. Like,
yeah, he's just a little sarcastic, like, repeating.
Yeah, it's funny.
I've lugged the gun around a little.
I did not expect that from, like, a 1932 movie.
No, but it really, like, bolsters the queer coding.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why does he keep doing this?
He really loves Joel McRae that much.
Ooh, a big, strong hunter man.
That's the gist of it. And there is some gnarly for the time violence here. Like, the trophy room sequence actually had to be cut a little bit because it was too much for test audiences back in 1932. Originally, they were going to show like a couple of stuffed humans displayed in the way that they were killed, but they had to cut that. And the footage is presumably lost forever, which is kind of unfortunate, but it's a nice little story to tell.
Yeah.
It's actually impressive how tiny the cast is on this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I was like, is there like 8 people in this whole movie? Like, it's so, it's just like tiny.
Yeah. There's like a
more. But yeah, every time I hear
more dogs about than there are humans.
Oh, yeah, tons of dogs. But every time I hear about test audiences from the 20s and 30s passing out or fleeing the theaters, and then you watch the movie and you're like, okay.
Yeah, these people lived through World War One.
Yeah. Like, how? So I'm always wondering about that. And I'm like, am I just too desensitized to film violence?
But you still get those stories now.
Yeah, it's true. I'm like, is this just marketing?
Yeah, probably.
But there's like...
Same as that story when the... What was the train arriving at so-and-so when it was shown that they all ran screaming?
Yeah.
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 The Lumiere brothers. Yeah, yeah, I think that's all marketing too, though.
Yeah, that's not... That didn't actually happen.
Yeah.
I think people were used to seeing photos. They knew there wasn't an actual train coming towards them.
Yeah, or like...
Also, I've watched that... I don't know how many times now. That actual... That clip. Or that film, we'll just say, because that's the entire film.
Yeah.
And it's not even coming right at you. It's like diagonal, guys. It's going on the screen. It's going to be okay. It's going to hit the people like heading towards the exit, if anything.
Supposedly, there's similar stories about the Great Train Robbery from 1903, which has like the famous scene of the gunman shooting his gun at the audience. Supposedly, audiences were freaking out because, oh, we're being shot at in the theater. But I don't know how true that is.
I love that they use that. That clip at the beginning of Tombstone, and they add an actual gun sound.
Okay, yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen Tombstone, but I vaguely remember something like that, yeah.
It is wonderful.
And the violence here in Most Dangerous Game, as I was saying, it is kind of graphic for the time. Obviously, by today's standards, it's not that graphic, but like I like the severed head on the wall that looks like Charlton Heston probably looks like these days. You know, and it does look like Chuck Heston probably looks like these days if you exhumed him. And there's like a severed head bobbing up in like a jar of fluids. And there's the aforementioned scene of the guy getting his spine snapped. There's a guy that gets like stabbed through the gut by like a reed, a sharp reed that like Joel McCrae puts in the ground. There's some good stuff here.
My favorite part of that is like it's right out in the open. So you're like, ah, well, there's no way they're going to. Like, I just assumed they're going to run around it. But the guy, like, went right into it.
Well,
and then everybody just ran right by him, like, eh, well, I guess he's fucked.
Yeah, it's...
Well, he got... In his defense, he got pulled into it by the dogs, basically.
Yeah. Well, I think that was his plan.
Yeah.
And it worked. It's like, it just so happened they happened to be running down the exact same path.
Joel McRae, he's so smart.
Yeah. It's no rattlesnake in a tree, but
it's
pretty.
Yeah.
It's up there.
The Most Dangerous Game, it's not a deep movie, but we kind of touched on this briefly, and I do love the scene where Joel McRae realizes that he feels how the animals he hunted used to feel. It does add a little something to the chase scene, like this moment of like this epiphany that, oh, those animals I hunted, now I know how they feel. And it's not a particularly deep moment, but it's a nice touch. It's not exactly all out anti-hunting, but it's just kind of like a nice little character arc for him.
No, they try and do that again in Hard Target. Like they try and replicate that moment, but they try and work it into the plot a little bit better, where he says, how does it feel to be hunted? And then he goes, you should know better. So it's like, well, they're trying. It's still like a clunky. I don't know. It's so obvious. It's such an obvious like idea that it, I don't know if you can really like verbalize it. And they keep trying.
They'll try and try again.
Well, they do set it up before when Joel McRae has a conversation with the doctor.
It's just like, okay, I hope that never happens to me. Well, it's you know, the best way to do it, I think, is like they do it in Predator, and they just don't say it. It's there, it's understood when he says, "They killed them one at a time," and he said, and then Billy says, "Like a hunter," like that's as much as you need. You're like, okay, we're good, we got it. There's a deleted scene from Predator that I'm glad they took out, where Arnold is being chased through the jungle, and Predator's kind of shooting around near him, and then he, to himself, says, "He's playing with me," or something along those lines. And you're like, you don't need the dialogue, and they smartly took that moment out.
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah, so sometimes less is more. And again, I give it a pass in this movie because it's 1932. We can, you know, they're learning dialogue. They're learning what works best.
Yeah.
And at least the main character in this movie has an arc.
Yeah.
Clunky though it is, but you know, it's something.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to wonder at the end of the movie if this guy will ever hunt again. Probably not.
Supposedly, like, the beginning scenes were going to be a lot longer because they expected a bigger budget. They were going to have, like, probably, like, scenes of him, Joel McRae's character, actually hunting and all this stuff, but they just didn't have the money, so they cut it down to this very efficient little opening scene of him on a boat, on a yacht, I guess, and it probably works better that way. They just kind of get all the exposition out of the way real quick, establish the themes of the movie, and they have the shipwreck scene where the whole boat blows up, which is pretty cool, and a guy gets eaten.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the guy gets eaten by a shark, and his last words are, "Oh, he got me!" Which makes me laugh every time. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, you know, I give it a pass. 1932.
I've never heard somebody so politely say that they're going to die.
Yeah.
There is that.
Like, I got to go. Look, I got to go, guys. That's what I said. I like that he still doesn't, like, climb up on the wreckage. He, like, no, I'm swimming for that. But it's good. That's a good proactive moment for our protagonist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did wait for everyone else to die, but then, works.
Yeah. You don't have to be faster than the shark. You only have to be faster than the other guy.
And I was watching the audio commentary... Listening to the audio commentary, I guess. And during this scene where, like, the shark bites the guy and, like, leaves a trail of, like, blood through the water, they had to, like, invert the colors of that scene for some releases because it was considered too gruesome, I guess. But, I mean, obviously, by today's standards, it's not much.
Oh, I think you can do that in a PG-13 movie, even.
Yeah. Well, Jaws is PG, so.
Of course, that was a long time ago. You know, before PG-13 existed.
Yeah. And I do really enjoy the shipwreck scene. I mean, it's really short, but it looks kind of great. Some obvious miniatures, but, you know, fuck it. It looks good.
Yeah,
I like miniature work.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah, you don't really think too much about the miniatures exactly. I mean, obviously, yes, it's a miniature, but it's so quick and so exciting, you don't really stop to think, like, oh, that must be some guy's bathtub that they're filming this in.
No.
It did make me wonder where they were filming it, but I don't know.
Yeah, there was a scene in all the way at the start of the 1996 Island of Dr. Moreau, when they're on the dinghy. And the water is just so clear that I'm like, where the fuck are they supposed to be? Like, is the ocean this clear? I don't...
Yeah, it's definitely not the Mississippi River where I live.
Yeah, I guess I have no idea. I have not seen very many versions of that movie. This movie, I've seen many remakes. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not even... Oh, I should also mention that I watched the colorized version. I've seen the black and white. This is the second time I've seen the Most Dangerous Game. And the first time I watched it was black and white. And this time I watched the colorized version. And it looks terrible.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe I have seen the colorized version once. Not during this viewing, but I have seen it before. And it just sticks out as black and white in my mind because it just does nothing interesting with the colors.
Okay.
I just think of it as black and white.
No. I mean, it's a gorgeous black and white movie. I don't see a reason to change that.
Having watched now the colorized version, I completely agree. Terrible. It looks really bad. But if you go onto the Wikipedia page, you can just... they have the whole movie up in black and white, and it looks great. So that's how I recommend watching it.
Mm-hmm. It is public domain in the United States, at least.
As well it should be.
Just a small aside, have you seen Turkey Shoot?
I've not seen
Turkey Shoot. No. So I want to watch it because I'm a big Brian Trenchard Smith fan, but it's one that I have not... I actually do own it, but I haven't watched it yet. I didn't know it was a remake of this.
Oh.
Well, I don't know if it is either, but it's another one of those being hunted for sport movies.
Okay.
You'll have to check that out sometime.
So currently
for
my
Thanksgiving.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Called Turkey Shoot, so why not? But yeah, my current favorite version of this is Hard Target, although I do like Surviving the Game. As big a fan of The Pest, but it is really funny. Because it's so terrible. And what are the other ones that I've seen like this?
Predator, maybe?
I brought up Naked Prey. Predator's not really, but I guess you could kind of, you know, it's kind of a twisted version, but sort of.
The Hunt?
I've not seen it.
Oh, me neither.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, that's because it's sort of like a left-wing parody, kind of. But I haven't seen that myself, but I've heard it's funny. Not funny and like out laugh out loud funny, but like darkly funny. The idea of that is like there's a bunch of liberal elites that hunt right-wingers. So it's like they kind of like turn it.
Yeah, now you don't know who to support anymore, do you?
But yeah, you have to see. I don't know. And then I guess there was a movie, the Mel Gibson movie Apocalypto, is kind of like it. I think that is a little bit more like there was an old movie called I think Run for the Sun.
Oh yeah, that's probably Run for the Sun with Richard Widmark. Yeah. That's very similar to The Most Dangerous Game.
Yeah, so I think that's very similar to Apocalypto.
Oh.
So, worth checking out.
Yeah.
Definitely check out Surviving the Game, though, if only for a fantastic Gary Busey dialogue. that movie and a fucking jump scare that he's in is so good that it's worth the price of admission alone.
Yeah, Surviving the Game is a good one, thanks to Gary Busey and the rest of the cast, too, like Rutger Hauer and Ice-T. They all do a good job.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're all trying to out-act one another.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm partial to The Most Dangerous Game myself, basically because it's so short, that it's so economical that I can't resist it. But I still love Hard Target and Predator as well.
Yeah. It was barely an hour long.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of which, but yeah. What did you appreciate?
I appreciate the bare bonesness of this one.
Yeah.
Like you said, 8 people in it. They go to an island, they get hunted, and that's it. It's amazing. So economical. Gets right down to it. No time to wait. And it just goes. It's amazing.
It hits the ground running.
Okay. So you want to talk about Island of Lost Souls then?
All right. It's definitely not an action movie like we usually cover, but it is an adventure movie, and I selected it due to its thematic similarities to The Most Dangerous Game. I mean, they're both short, 1932 pre-code adventure horror movies about shipwreck survivors being trapped on a madman's personal island. So, I mean, they're pretty similar.
A gay-coded madman with weird facial
hair. Okay, I forgot about that important detail. And I love this movie. This is probably my favorite horror movie of all time. I just love the thick atmosphere of depravity, cruelty, sadism, and sweatiness to the whole thing. It just feels like somebody's nightmare set to film, you know, kind of like Eraserhead or a Shyandaloo, you know, like one of those type of movies. It just, it's such a nightmare to watch that I love it.
I like it because I thought it was kind of funny. I enjoyed the complete misunderstanding of how evolution works, which is fantastic to me. That's like the plot hinges on this, which is why it was great when he finally explained it. He's like, oh no, I sped evolution up. See, everything's trying to become a person. I was like, I don't think that's how evolution works, man.
Yeah, that's the part where I was like, what is he doing? How? What? Huh? He took 10,000 years of evolution from it, and then he put it back or something? Like, and why are plants just getting bigger, but are animals turning human?
Yeah.
I mean, that part is pretty silly, but I love this movie. I mean,
what has there's some interesting themes in this movie going on that I did really appreciate. There's this concept, and you still hear people say this shit today, where they're like, we're regressing, we're turning back into animals. So he's like flipping it, and he's trying to turn animals into people, but he can't stave off that the animal keeps coming back. And that's like his problem, as it were. And he's always fighting that. And that's what ultimately, you know, when you brought up that the protagonist cheated on his wife immediately, where he's like, the only thing that stops him is that, like, she's just fucking gorgeous. And then he's like, oh no, there's like, there's something in the ends of her fingers that he just doesn't like.
Yeah.
He's like, it's a bridge too far. If she was just a little more perfect, he would have done it.
You'll rip my butthole with this.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some interesting themes in here. And it almost plays out like an antinatalistic fairy tale, with the creatures rising up in righteous rage against their callous creator, who made them pathetic, sad human beings that live in misery. There's just like this righteous rage for the whole thing. There's just this anger, this like burning hatred. And it's also sometimes compared to like an allegory about Christian creation, with like Dr. Moreau being a sort of like God/Satan hybrid, and Parker and Loda almost ending up as like an unwitting Adam and Eve couple in the Garden of Eden. I mean, it's, I don't know if this was intentional, but I mean, it adds some flavor to the movie, I think.
I think that it might be intentional. There's a whole part where once they realize that their God, Dr. Moreau, is a hypocrite, that's when they really revolt. Because he's like, oh, well, he asked me to kill. You're like, but he told us that killing is wrong, basically.
That is true.
You're like, well, he's no good then.
It's almost like some sort of allegory for like religious belief or something like that. It's interesting.
Yeah, this is one of those movies where you're like, oh, I see why the religious conservatives of the U.S. hated Hollywood now. Because of this shit.
Yeah, and this film was extremely controversial upon its initial release, with it being banned in several countries, including Great Britain, for its violence, kinkiness, blasphemy, and general gruesomeness. They decided, this is too much for audiences, we're not even going to release it, period. Although it did really get.
I think that there was speaking of the kinkiness, there was a part where, you know, when they introduced her, and then she's just like, she loves rubbing her, like, shoulders and stuff up against him, and I was like, oh, this is probably where furries come from.
They come from the 1932 film The Island of Lost Souls.
Yeah. I was like, somebody was like, you know what, she could be more of a
and I wouldn't mind. Yeah.
This is not the first version of this film I've seen. The first version of this film I've seen was a 1972 movie called Twilight People, and the Roger Corman produced movie, and it's slightly different plot, but very similar. But it's clearly based on the same H.G. Wells story. And there is a Panther Woman in that, but it's Pam Grier. So And she does have more of a Panther face, much more, and she makes Panther sounds. But she's got Pam Grier's body, so you're just like, well, there's just no way that you're going to resist her. Except that she bites people's necks and kills them.
Okay.
So.
Still would.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Well, now I'm a furry. Yeah.
Now, the first version of this I watched was Jurassic Park.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm. Yeah, the man is God.
Stuck on an island with animals running wild. I mean, it's probably not an actual remake or anything, but it shares a lot with it, I think.
Michael Crichton, you hack.
Yeah. And there was a 1970s... No. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that that's actually a really good spot because I didn't think of it, but as soon as you said it, I was like, no, that's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. I don't even think that's a... That's not even a reach. It's very similar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. What's another 70s version? Probably more official than the Roger Corman one I referenced.
Yes, there was a 1977 remake starring Burt Lancaster as Dr. Moreau titled The Island of Dr. Moreau. It's pretty good, but it's not particularly memorable. I mean, it's a little less gruesome than the original, but I mean, it's a good movie if you just want to watch like the story, which is a good story. But more famously, a remake of the title The Island of Dr. Moreau was released in 1996 with Marlon Brando as Moreau. And that's the interesting one. The violence in the director's cut of the 1996 movie is more graphic and detailed than the 1932 version, but it doesn't have the same horrifying undertones of the 1932 one. There's not really any vivisection or bestiality in the Brando one, so it feels oddly tame compared to the other one, which was released decades before it. But Brando's Moreau is more of like a somewhat sadistic, highly misguided father figure, as opposed to the camp Lucifer that Charles Laughton's Moreau is. But it's worth watching.
Yeah, it's interesting that they would try and get like a big, known actor every time for the Dr. Moreau part. Mm-hmm. Are they doing the same thing in that, where he's turning animals into people?
Yeah, but it's...
because.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Okay, because mm-hmm. I thought... When I first, I don't know, for some reason, and I guess I should rewatch the 72 version, but I had thought he was turning people into animals. Mm-hmm. Now I'm like, after watching this one, oh. So for some reason, had not occurred to me.
Well, I was under the assumption that he would combine animals and humans.
Mm. That'd make an interesting movie.
But then again, why?
He's a mad scientist.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Which, have you not seen Bats?
The 96 version, even though it's like 64 years later that it came out, still has no sensible explanation of what he's doing. Like the 32 version didn't understand evolution. The 90s version didn't understand anything either.
No.
And the 90s version is like less gruesome in some ways than the 1932 version. Like the scene where the main character breaks into the House of Pain or whatever you want to call it. In the 96 version, it's just like an animal giving birth. But in the 1932 version, it's Dr. Moreau like vivisecting a gorilla or whatever. So there's some differences there that make like the 96 version a little less disturbing than it should be.
I find both of those prospects incredibly disturbing. Oh, yeah. So, I actually, just the fact that there's constant screaming coming from this House of Pain, I'm like, yeah, I find it very unnerving, you know, just like the characters did. He's just like, okay. My favorite thing, though, is the Montgomery character being like, you want them to mate or whatever. He's like, that's too far. But you know, slave labor and crossing humans with animals and vivisecting them and torturing and them screaming and creating your own laws and your own society out of it, that's fine. But
yeah, that is kind of a weird moment. And
Yeah, he's...
Yeah, it's really kind of disturbing at one point. This movie doesn't have a lot of on-screen violence, but what is implied and attempted is truly messed up. I mean, we have vivisection and near sex with animals. It's utterly depraved. And there's one scene that just gets me, like, where, like, Dr. Moreau is examining the teeth of this, like, ape man on the operating table, and the ape man is just screaming, like, ah! Like, he's screaming his guts out, and just, like, Dr. Moreau is just, like, casually examining his mouth and his teeth as if he's not even a living thing. Like, just, like, yeah. This guy is evil.
Well, the fact that he sets up a situation where the big ape thing is gonna attack Layla Hyams is and he's just like watching in the dark. I find that scene pretty stomach turning.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like that is what Montgomery's has a problem with. And I was like, I guess I have a problem with that too. But because they're not playing to our sympathies with the creatures too much. The message is a little confused. I think that they could have easily made us really sympathize with the creatures.
Yeah.
Instead, I just kind of generally agree with them.
Yeah.
You know, when they're doing the no more law or whatever, I was like, yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, that's a fair criticism of the film. I mean, I do sympathize with the manimals a lot. I do think that their plight is very understandable, but I mean, if you don't agree with that, that's fine. And
are you sympathizing with them because of their circumstance, or do you just think Kathleen Burke is hot?
Why not both? You know.
Yeah.
And there's some great like delivery of lines here that I just love. Like, I adore the lines like, "You made us not men, not beasts, pod man, pod beast, things." I love that line from Bela Lugosi. We haven't even brought up Bela Lugosi yet. He plays the Sayer of the Law, who's kind of like the leader of the manimals, who like says like their laws and they chant it. Kind of a weird scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I love lines like, "This is the House of Pain," which is said by Dr. Moreau. And then like Bela Lugosi replies with, "House of Pain." And Bela Lugosi's lines are just, I love Bela Lugosi in this movie. He has such great delivery of his lines. I love it.
No, if anything, you could have used more him, because I find his character, who is seems to be the guy that just knows the law, as they keep calling it, I really like whatever he's doing. I'm like, that's interesting. It's sort of implied that he may be the first one to have spoken.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's cool. And then, you know, they points out that Loda is the first one to cry. Mm-hmm. But they generally can all speak. But I'm like, oh, this guy, he's the one who keeps repeating the law, so he must be the guy that first learned it. And that's what he says. Mm-hmm. And he's also the one that's like, yep, you're right, no more law. and when he says it, they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're all listening to him, and I'm like, that's cool. There's like a lot of implied things going on in the movie, and I like that. Movies nowadays could probably learn from that.
Mm-hmm.
As much as things do hit you over the head in this movie, there are things that are applied that I like. The one thing that, you know, like early in the movie when they do like this really funny zoom into the names of the shipwreck people, and then they're like, oh, in case you didn't get it, we're going to like darken the rest of it afterwards. Like, no, like, we're serious. Look at this name.
And then like, it's supposed to mean something at that point.
Yeah. So like, that's how like not subtle the movie can be. And which is funny, because then there'd be these things where you're like, oh, that's interesting. You know, he's talking about his research and like, that's cool. You know, what does this imply? Like, how long has he been doing this? And then he gets this guy, the Montgomery character, where he's like, oh yeah, he had like some personal scandal, and so of course he signed up with me. And you're like, what was that? And you're like, is that part of the gay coding? Like, what was going on there?
I didn't think about that.
And then he says, when he's talking about the Panther Woman, he goes, we are, you know, this is gonna be the first man of his type that she's seen, because we don't count. And you're like, oh, there's something going on here. But you know, there's like the implications of what they're saying, which is neat.
Yeah. They wouldn't be weird to her because cats lick their buttholes too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting talking about like the gay coding for like Dr. Moreau, because the Criterion Collection audio commentary by Gregory Mank, it kind of points out that Dr. Moreau is like a sadomasochist, and his howls of agony as he's vivisected to death at the end almost sound erotic. And now, I've not come to kink shame, but that boy ain't right. I mean, if you're getting your entrails ripped out and you're getting a chubby, that's not right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's... Does he long for his own destruction? Because he does almost everything he can to make it happen.
Ooh.
So, you know, that's a... It's a, that's a question. It's an interesting question. But maybe it's just that he is mad, as they say.
Yeah, the oppressing a large group of people when you're just two people yourself, that can go right for very long.
No.
Yeah.
Should have seen that one coming.
Kathleen Burke, to bring her up again, apparently this movie kind of ruined her career. It started it and ruined it just as quickly. She tried to shake being known as the Panther Woman forever, and it just never happened. Like the rest of the decade before she just retired. Yeah. But I think it's because when the movie opens and it says Charles Laughton and Richard Arlen and the Panther Woman, you know, you're like, oh, it doesn't say Kathleen Burke as the Panther Woman. It's just like the Panther Woman. Like, oh, well, that's because they didn't tell you her fucking name.
Yeah, that was weird.
So, like, I thought that was her name.
They don't even tell you her character's name.
Well, they keep saying Loda in the movie.
Yeah, but like in the credits, it's just Panther Woman. She doesn't look like a panther. Who the fuck is the Panther Woman?
Well,
that's what I'm saying. That. Yeah, and that's why people are furries, but they could have been more obvious. I don't know.
Well,
give her some cute ears.
Well, like supposedly there's this nationwide like woman hunt for like the woman to play the Panther Woman in Island of Lost Souls. And supposedly, I think like the audio commentary said there was something like 60,000 women who like tried to sign up for like this contest basically to be the Panther Woman, because this was the Great Depression and they needed money. So they're like, oh, I'm going to be a movie star. I'm going to be in Island of Lost Souls as the furry Panther Woman. And Kathleen Burke won.
That makes it more sad.
Yeah.
Didn't we recently talk about, like, oh, yeah, no, they definitely searched all over, but they just so happened to find the producer's daughter was the...
Yes, the person who's dating the producer or something like that, yeah.
Yeah. But that's not the case for her. That's good.
Yeah. And the ending of this movie, it feels like the apocalypse. Like, all the fire and the destruction and the death and the vivisection. Like, all the mammals, are they wiped out by the fire at the end? I mean, like, Dr. Montgomery has, like, a line that says, like, oh, the fire will consume Kathleen Burke's dead body or something like that. And did, like, is this island completely, like, wiped flat by the fire at the end? I mean, it just feels like Armageddon at the end.
I think it's implied, yeah.
I'm not sure, by the way, how does she die? I didn't understand that at all.
She died being strangled by Oran, one of the more loyal apes to Dr. Moreau or something like that. They killed each other.
Yeah, underneath
the tree.
He does
rather easily kill, what was that? The captain.
Donahue.
Yeah.
Donahue, the Scandinavian captain, by the way. Because when they're drinking the wine, he says, score.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is Danish for cheers.
Ooh.
I think, like, Donahue, it's a real Danish name. That's
I guess.
Okay,
I don't know.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
So the theme is definitely like a kind of like fight against our animal nature to be civilized, and the movie does really bring it home in this really fun way because of the fire, this apocalyptic thing you're describing. the last line of the film is "Don't look back," which is great because you're like, that just hammers home that theme of like, no, we have to keep moving forward, we have to keep progressing, we have to keep evolving. Because our animal nature is not gone, so don't look back. I'm like, that's great. This is like fantastic. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, the writing is coming together. The screenwriter should be congratulated.
Yeah, and apparently H.G. Wells didn't like the adaptation because supposedly, he didn't like that it was a horror movie, and he would have preferred if it had more of his philosophical themes in it.
Ooh. Yeah, I would say that they're there, although I haven't read the novel, so I couldn't tell you if the themes of his novels are accurately replicated. But the movie's themes are there. Maybe they're the opposite of what he was going for. Maybe he's like, no, we should go back to the animal.
I want to lick my own bottle.
It's like, why can't I do this? I've tried so many times.
Yeah.
No one remembers my dang invisible man, but not my butthole. Yeah.
No, but my main issue maybe with the movie, if I can call it an issue, is that maybe it tries to juggle too many themes at once, because like, there's like so much potential in this story, and maybe it was just too much.
Maybe.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here.
I know, it feels like it could have used a bit more of something, I think. I don't know what exactly. Yeah, the 90s remake doesn't succeed either, so I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot being juggled here. Like, you've got kind of like the element of like progressing in evolution. You have like the sort of like the religious like allegory and the antinatalist allegory. You have all this kind of floating around, and for me it works. I think this movie's a masterpiece. It's probably my favorite horror movie of all time, but I mean, for like 70 minutes, this movie is 70 minutes long. I mean, there's a lot here. It's like an hour long, and there's a lot of content in this movie, which I appreciate. It's probably my favorite horror movie of all time.
Yeah, I will say I wasn't entirely sold on this movie, but like I wouldn't mind watching it again, like maybe even in a month or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very good. It's really bolstered by some good performances and some really good cinematography. It really uses effectively the shadows and stuff that make black and white films great.
And great but, sets and locations, yeah, too.
The giant asparagus. That's what sort of did
it. And I like the scene where he points out, like, that used to be a lily. And it, like, shows, like, this lily flower, but you have, like, no context on how big it is or small it is or anything.
No, it's just a close-up of a lily.
Still looks like
a lily. Yeah, it's like, what changed? I don't know.
What's going on?
They should have put a tiny frog on it.
Hey, that would have been great. Yeah. And this movie left quite a mark on the world of like music, because like the new wave band Devo, they have a song called Jocko Homo that quotes this movie. It goes like, "Are we not men? We are Devo. Are we not men? We are Devo." And there's another new wave act, Oingo Boingo, that also references the saga of Dr. Moreau with their song "No Spill Blood." And it may have partially inspired the Van Halen song House of Pain and the Blondie song Island of Lost Souls. So there's some like influence here, I think, on the musical scene.
What about the rap group House of Pain?
Oh, yeah. House of Pain. Yeah, it's... I don't know why it caught on with all these musicians, but it did, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think there's something kind of timeless about this weird-ass story. And yeah, that really comes through there. And I'm guessing that if you're an artist, a creative, that's going to affect you. And that's what, so all these people that did this, you know, these music and probably, I'm guessing, visual artists of some kind have all probably taken plenty from this movie, and it's probably affected them deeply, because the movie is thick with, you know, themes and meaning. So yeah, I can totally see. I don't know about the House of Pain guy. I don't know what his his background is. I always thought he was like a street rapper type. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm guessing still you watch this and maybe as a young boy and it's just like, well, that fucked with me. And you think of House of Pain all the damn time. Like, oh, my God, I'm going to name my band that. He's explaining this. No, this is Hot Panther Lady. Anyways, House of Pain. That's what we're going to call our group.
Yeah. Is that calling it Hot Panther Lady?
Yeah. Yeah.
God, that would have been a great band name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hot Panther Lady is like an awesome. That's what Blondie should have gone by.
Yeah.
Instead of making that song.
Yeah. That would be great.
Yeah. I definitely recommend both these, especially since they're, as you keep bringing up, very short, very easy double feature to do. You could watch both of these in the times it take to watch almost any other movie. So, yeah, definitely recommend.
Yeah, for me, I think I watched The Most Dangerous Game earlier this year for the first time, so this was my second viewing, and I just love it, man. It's
yeah,
short, it's great, it's got everything you need. A lot of people might have something against really old movies. You know, if you want to start watching really old movies, start with these, because they're great.
Yeah. I mean, you could probably watch any of these, the old RKO stuff, and enjoy them. You could do, like, when Dracula came out the year before this, and King Kong the year after. I mean, just, like, think of that. Like, those four movies right there that I think, it's like, what a great intro to old 30s films. Like, all you, boom, 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 you know? All these, and they're all pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
For different reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of the original Dracula, but yeah.
I like more what it's going for than what it is. I think the thing that it definitely fails to be scary in any meaningful way. And but I really like a lot of the cinematography in it, and I like I really like Bela Lugosi. He's fun.
Yeah.
He gives that great line, I don't drink wine.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, that's good.
Great.
Yeah, I like his line, children of the night. Oh, what music they make. I think that's a great line. But I agree with Marty that it's not really a great movie. I mean, it's okay, but it's not like what it should be.
I watched it recently with the Philip Glass to recorded a whole score for it. And it's great.
Oh.
I think it really makes the movie buzz, but it's still not scary. But yeah, definitely recommend these. Check them out. Dracula optional. King Kong, I think is a must.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should watch that definitely.
Yeah.
Same cast as Most Dangerous Game, or not entirely, but the ones that matter.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the
Scarface that we talked about on
the
previous episode, Adventures of Robin Hood, which is, I think, Technicolor, so it's very different. Yeah, those are two great 30s movies as well. I think The Most Dangerous Game out of the four we've discussed is my favorite.
Oh, okay. It's probably my second favorite after Island of Lost Souls. I mean, Most Dangerous Game and Island of Lost Souls, those movies are two masterpieces for me. I've seen those movies so many times, but I still love Scarface and The Adventures of Robin Hood as well.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But maybe we should talk someday. Someday we'll get to King Kong and Son of Kong, which was released the same year. So, yeah, the sequel. Maybe we'll throw in Mighty Joe Young in there too, the original Mighty Joe Young.
Well, I watched King Kong a ton as a kid. So I watched it. I've never seen Son of Kong.
Oh, okay. Ooh. It's pretty good.
Okay.
Throw in a little Queen Kong.
Yeah.
It's not supposedly not very good.
One of these times.
Yep.
But yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I think that's about all I gotta say about these movies in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
What?
So people should go check out the website, alloutofbubblegum.com. Check out, join the Discord, subscribe to the podcast, check out the Patreon, where I think by now we have a new episode up, hopefully. And we'll see you next week.
All right.
All right.
Bye-bye.
See you guys later.
Bye.
We're pinheads now. We are not old. We're pinheads all. Shot the low. Are we not men?
We are Nemo.
Are we not men?
Nemo.
Are we not men?
We are Nemo.